Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Okay, we're underway, folks. This is The Media Project. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here. That would be the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, Dr. Shartok. Good morning.
Good day.
Ira Fussfeld, the publisher of The Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Hello.
Yes, sir. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of The Times Union. We're all glad to be here. Are we all glad to be here?
Yeah, no, we were all glad to be here. But I want to know, what is each of our worst traits?
Our worst traits?
Yes.
Can I tell you yours?
Yes. And then I'll tell you yours.
I don't even know. I'm impatient with idiots. No, I don't know.
I take Sorry. That somewhat personally.
I don't know why you would say that. All right. Did you want to answer the question?
No, I'll tell you what mine is.
What's yours?
Mine is that I love getting into trouble, but I just don't like it when I'm there.
You look for trouble,
yeah.
In my humble opinion.
Yeah. Yes. Well, if I were you, I would say to me,
yes.
You look for trouble because you don't.
I don't shy away from trouble. I don't look for trouble.
So you're like Clint Eastwood?
Yes, very much like Clint Eastwood.
In this day and age, trouble tends to find a newspaper publisher.
Yes.
You know,
he doesn't have to.
Yes, there's plenty
no,
of
he's been
trouble.
Known to tangle with public officials and others and stand his ground.
This yes. has
and
been,
advertisers
this is true.
Who want to push him around.
Yes, you need to have some integrity.
We have a couple of letters today that go into an issue that brings trouble to journalists all the time, and that is religion. They say that in polite company, you shouldn't talk about religion and politics, but we have a couple of letters that raise a question about religion in the media. One of them from a WAMC member in Germantown says, thank you for your entertaining and informative discussions about issues in and about the media. He says that there's a trend that he noticed last week. Last week, same-sex marriage was a big topic in the news, and I was disturbed by what appeared to be a very deferential treatment of clergy by reporters. One pastor was interviewed by both Barbara Bradley Haggerty on NPR and by Soledad O'Brien on CNN and repeatedly said that anti-same-sex marriage and anti-gay language was irrefutably in the Bible. He said numerous times that there is neither black and white, but that's just not true, according to this reader. What he said was very refutable. Neither reporter asked him to explain his statement in light of other clergy's opinion or non-fringe biblical scholarship. Why did they take him at his word? And this person actually offers an answer here. In most instances, the media won't question the clergy's statement regarding the Bible. Rather, they count it with someone who dismisses the Bible altogether, or with a proponent of the separation of church and state, both of which are different issues. This fuels the dangerous and misguided dichotomy. This is a really smart concept. This fuels the dangerous and misguided dichotomy, which reduces the public to those for religion and those against it. It's very interesting. You know, reporters are afraid, I think, to write about religion much because most of us are not very knowledgeable of it. And so when you have someone who quotes scripture, say, knowledgeably, especially if it's someone
sure,
who...
Sure, thou shalt not liest with man as thou wouldest with woman before it is abomination.
Wow.
Leviticus.
Whoa.
And I think that and I did not see either of these two interviews, but I would think that there is a concern about looking like you're beating up on clergy if you're trying to cross-examine them on the air.
I always hate to interrupt you, but I have yet another theory.
Yes.
My theory is that all of us don't know enough. We never know enough.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, I, for example, have a program here called Congressional Corner, and every day we talk to a different congressman or congresswoman, and I'll have a liberal on, and somebody will call a conservative and say, why didn't you ask him this? Or I'll have Nan Hayworth, and he'll say, why don't you beat her up? Why don't you know more about it because I don't, because there's a limit on how much any of us can know.
That's right.
And so what you do is you tend to let them have their say, which I think is a terrific service on WAMC. You know, they come on, they say their thing. Everybody's smart. Some people say that's nonsense and hear them talking and some don't. But you don't have to be the filter in all of this. And that would be my answer.
I think that's really especially true for that kind of interview. Let people have a chance to speak anyway.
Sure.
And rather than trying to be an expert in everything and thereby making a fool of yourself when you're not. This reader's point on this is, would the media be so easy on an economist, a CEO, or a constitutional scholar as the media seems to be on clergy? And I think it goes to exactly the point you raised, though. We're not
constitutional
experts.
Scholars either.
It's closer, though. It's easier to be a constitutional scholar or to pose as one as a reporter. People are really uncomfortable when it comes to covering religion.
Well, that's interesting. You know, the other day I was speaking with pro-frackers, the head of the pro-fracking group here in Albany.
As opposed to amateur frackers, yeah. The pro-frackers, the pro-frackers Association of America.
Amateur frackers like animal crackers.
Yes.
Okay, pro-frackers can really go horizontal.
Yeah, but she turned around and she said, you know, it's clear that these are rights that Americans should enjoy to do whatever they do with the land or whatever else. I've read the Constitution as a history major, and I've read history, and I know. And I said, well, you know, I'm a full professor of political science. Said, oh, that's just political science. There's always an answer here.
But, you know, we faced this some years ago when we were starting to do editorial board meetings with candidates for office. And it dawned on us very early on that if we had candidate X come in, we were putting ourselves in the position of trying to debate candidate X in challenging their assertions. And A, we didn't want to be put into that adversarial position. And B, we didn't really know a lot of the subject matter, particularly when it was an incumbent. I mean, as you guys know, an incumbent in the legislature can come in and somebody say, you didn't pass that bill. Well, it was because it was tacked on to this bill. And we didn't want to do that. So we started inviting for the editorial boards both candidates and let them talk.
Wow.
And it was sort of like a mini debate.
What an interesting idea.
Yeah, and it works pretty well because it gave them the opportunity to question each other, and it let us listen and absorb.
Now, Rex, you don't do that on your newspaper, which is a very good newspaper.
It's hard to do, by the way, is you got to schedule it, and some of them don't want to do it.
If you've got one big leader in the race,
yeah,
they're not going to walk in the room with some guy who wants some publicity.
Yeah,
right.
But I think you're right. You know, you're going to sit there interviewing someone on the radio. Your job is to ask them questions. It's really not to debate them so much. And if you don't know the subject matter as well as they do, you're putting yourself in a position of sounding stupid on the air. And who would want that?
You know what? I think this is a very good discussion. I really do. Every once in a while,
I challenge that.
Every once in a while, I'm impressed with us.
Oh, dear. I like that idea of a little debate for the editorial board.
I think it can be. You'll find that it's not impossible to do. It's harder the higher the office. But assemblymen, senators, mayoral candidates, you can pretty well do it.
I can't imagine Senator Kirsten Gillibrand last year agreeing to sit down with that guy. What's his
name?
And
I want to see what will happen going forward, because we are now attempting to live stream these things.
Oh, yeah.
And then they may see it as another official debate. So we have to mull that one over.
We've had officials who have refused to even let us, they will not come in for an editorial board if we say we're going to video it.
That's
usually video them and put up segments later, and a lot of them don't like that.
And are you agreeing to that condition?
We have gone back and forth on it.
Yeah.
First, we were saying, no, we must do it. And then sometimes we're thinking, you know, maybe we're wrong. Maybe we should use this sparingly. But I don't know that we can do that.
I think we not only are trying to live stream, but we are also soliciting questions. We publicize it in advance and ask the readers to contribute. And
cool.
We also run on our large screen. There's a format called Cover It Live, and you can write questions during the session. So you're able to get that contribution. Now, this is all part of the whole new crowdsourcing,
mm-hmm.
Involvement mantra that's out there. So it's important to us to get community engagement. movement, because I think we've discussed it before. We're no longer the gatekeepers. The public wants to be involved, and so we're trying to get them involved. So,
well, does the public want to be involved, or just do a few stinkers want to be involved? That's always that's always the issue. I mean, we tend to hear, you know, I mean, there's some people who are very good and very great and call all the time, but then there are a couple of people who just want to make some trouble and, you know, aren't the nicest of folks. And what I find on some of these blogs is five people grab it and take it over, mm-hmm. And, you know, just say whatever.
That can be a problem. We have certain people whose names I could tell you who are always commenting on all, they'll comment on six blogs on a given day that we
sure.
have.
And not only on your newspaper, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure they're all over.
But
yeah.
But you'll have instances. We've just experienced it within the last week. We have two major issues. One we all have, which is the school board elections and the votes. And the other one in our case is the potential of closing one hospital in Kingston. Mm-hmm. And yes, those same five people are evident on our comment board, but those particular issues have brought in a whole new group of people. So
sure.
you do get them if they're interested
and,
in it.
And here's an advantage of the crowdsourcing for editorial boards specifically. I remember as a reporter going to editorial board meetings. When I was a reporter at Newsday, the tradition there was that reporters would be invited in to cover editorial board meetings. We do that at the Times Union also, usually. Sometimes at Newsday, they would have closed editorial boards. But I remember going into these meetings where, for example, the first Governor Cuomo would be there, and I would be really almost embarrassed at the superficial questions being asked by the editorial board, because as a reporter, you know all the stuff.
You know what the
answers are going to be. You hear every day what this person is going to be saying and thinking, boy, how superficial. On the other hand, the editorial board was asking questions that ordinary citizens might, and ordinary citizens will bring expertise to the editorial board questions that either reporters or editors wouldn't.
That's right, and that's also part of this new ecology, that the public knows a lot more about subjects than we do in many cases. So mm-hmm. why close them out for the proceedings?
Now, Rex, your paper, of course, is larger than Ira's by a couple of factors. Does this mean what you're saying, Ira, do you ever invite your reporters into the...
Our editorial board, you know, we will often get requests from people to say, we'd like to meet with your editorial board. And then they're surprised to learn that the editorial board may be me if my schedule is there, and then the editor, and then we bring in a reporter, and the reporter really isn't part of the editorial board in that he does not make the decisions for the editorial page, but we want him or her there to ask questions and to transcribe the event. So it's different. I mean, Rex's paper has an editorial board that's more formal than ours, and of course, the real big ones like the New York Times, that's just a separate department. It's on a separate floor that you'd never see anywhere near the newsroom.
Right. So, a dozen people could be engaged in a meeting there. Though sometimes we only have a couple of people who will meet with people. When I was the editor of the Troy paper, of the Record in Troy, you know, I wrote every editorial myself for 4 years that I was the editor. One time, Senator
You're
Daniel...
You're a very good editorial writer. I want to tell everybody about that, because I'm impressed
that you've
taken over more activity on your editorial board, on your paper. There's no question in my mind that the editorials have improved.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
Faint.
Thank you. I... Mark the day of this kindness. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan came to us once at the Troy Record, and I was delighted that he was coming. And I remembered, you know, I had just taken over this editorship and I'd been at Newsday. And I remembered at Newsday, they had an executive chef. And when important people would come, they would make a fine meal for him. And I didn't know what to do, but I thought I should have some hospitality for Senator Moynihan. So I made a batch of bran muffins and had bran muffins for the senator. And he came in clutching a book under his arm of architectural history and said he was going to go to the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, this architectural and acoustical gem.
The best acoustics in the world.
Marvelous place.
Yeah.
And he put forth an argument that I will never forget. He put forth the argument that Troy had been saved by bad government. He said, wonderful city, Troy. We used to come here when I was on Governor Harriman's staff, and we had fat friends on the faculty at Russell Sage College. And Troy was saved by bad government because you see, the government was so bad that when every other city was tearing down the buildings, Troy was saved because the city hadn't been able to access
Take
the federal
down.
Funds. And I later read in a New York Times magazine story by Adam DeGurney, he had the same argument about Rome, New York, that Rome also had bad government. And therefore,
let me ask you guys a question,
story.
A technique question.
Wait a minute, that was that Rex Smith imitating Jimmy Stewart?
No, he was right on target.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you, I was going to do it, but I didn't think it was nice. But he came in here once, and we had the Legislative Gazette students here to ask him a question. And he clearly didn't want to be here. Hmm. And he turned around to me and he said, "Now, what is your PhD in?" And I said, "In political science." And he said, "What did you write your dissertation on?" And I said, "I wrote it on mental health policy making in New York State." He said, "Well, I know a great deal about that." And he wouldn't shut up. In other words, here were the students asked, brought into the thing to ask him a question, and he just filibustered. I mean, it was so one time.
Well, that can happen at editorial boards too, let me tell you, yeah, by the way, on topic. Go right ahead.
That was exactly the point that I was eventually going to get to, maybe.
Glad to help
you. Get down to one time he allows me to interview him. And I come down to Washington, specially for it, and I go into the room, and he says, "Walk me over to the Senate. I have to introduce Volcker." That's how long ago it was, for his second term, because he was the state United States Senator from Volcker's hometown. He goes in, and the chairman of the committee says to him, "Now, Pat," and I hear the guy say, the chairman of the committee says, "Now, Pat, just a few words of introduction." Well, that must have ticked him off. That must have ticked him off some. He started with George Washington, and he went to the present day, and he wouldn't shut up. So they can ruin you if they decide never to put a period in the sentence.
This happens in editorial board meetings all the time, and you rue the day that you said, lead us off with some thoughts.
And what do? I mean, I cut him off.
Yeah, I think you have to. I think you have to sometimes just be rude and say, "Excuse me, we have some more questions for you here."
Now, there are other guys you can do, and women you can do that with. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you could have done that with Pat Moynihan. He would have strangled you.
Here's another letter, by the way. We were talking about, just very quickly, about religion. This person wrote a couple of weeks ago, and we didn't read the letter because it has to do with a columnist in a newspaper who is noted by his readers as being an atheist. And according to this writer, the fellow wrote a bunch of columns that were, quote, violently anti-Israel and anti-Jewish, lacking both in accuracy and balance, for which he made no apologies, leading to meetings with members of the clergy, the editor saying there's nothing the paper would or should do, that a columnist is free to print whatever he wishes. And so the writer who was upset about this, now remember, this is the letter writer saying that the columns were anti-Jewish and anti-Israel.
Yes, because let's all remember that there's a big difference between having differences with the Israeli government and Netanyahu and being anti-Semitic.
Yes, exactly. So this person asks, what I want to understand is the role of a columnist, the independence of a columnist, the responsibility, if any, of the publisher for what is said, and the role of the editor to monitor insightful speech, that's C-I-T-E, not insightful, S-I-G-H-T, to monitor insightful speech and check on facts. And what is the extent of the First Amendment right to free speech, and when does a columnist cross the line into hate mongering and dangerous material? What is a newspaper's criteria for defining hate speech, and at what point does an editor decide to limit the discussion of a hot button issue?
Well, I think the publisher, the editor, has an absolute right to cancel a column that does not fit the criteria that this writer suggests that columnist, and I'm not familiar with that columnist, doesn't fit. I mean, hopefully the publisher will want a wide variety of views among its columnists, whether or not you agree with that view. And your determination is how well written it is, how well the argument is made, and is the argument based on some modicum of truth. And in my view, if it fits those criteria, even if I disagree with every word of the column stays in the paper. Now, I don't know the circumstances regarding this column, but if the column is not factual, the making opinions that are not based on fact, that gives me reason for pause.
Now, let me just say that my column appears in several papers, and Ira is one of them. And this week, I heard from Ira. He didn't like something. And that was, I wrote a sort of silly column about, you know, everybody's writing a book about Andrew Cuomo, and I'm going to write a novel. And it's going to have nothing to do with anybody living or dead, and I'm going to call the guy Anthony, you know, not Andrew. But I had made several references in the beginning to Andrew as opposed to Governor Cuomo or to Cuomo, which is, I think, the preferred way. And Ira said, maybe you should, you know, change this. And I wrote back to Ira, being a docile fellow as I am, and said, Ira, anything you want, do it.
The milk of human kindness by the cord in every vein.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, shall I get into I mean, when the columnist cites Cuomo and it's not immediately clear whether it's Andrew or Mario, then clearly you need to mention which is which. Alan has been frequently writing columns making reference to the governor as Andrew. I have been changing it almost always to Cuomo because that's our style. It's clear we're talking about the current governor. And I mentioned to Alan, and Alan may want it this way, and I suspect he does, which is why he wrote it, that the use of the first name suggests something of a, lack of respect.
It's almost not diminutive.
That's the way I'd
put
it.
You think so?
And you're dismissive, right?
Yeah.
You know what I just said? You think so? So, but what's interesting about this is that if you talk to any insider in Albany, they never talk about Cuomo. They always talk about Andrew.
But are they doing it because
of universally known in Albany among the insiders as Andrew? Am I right, Rex?
Yes, I think we're all trying to learn to say governor out of respect.
But it's
hard.
Is it because the Albany insiders do want to distinguish between Mario and Andrew?
No.
It's because they knew him.
And they knew him when he was
Andrew.
You're just Andrew.
Yeah.
And so he's Andrew to everybody here. And my hope with the column is to invite everybody in.
So this was an editing exercise on Ira's part. But Alan, have you ever had a publisher refuse to run a column you've written because they didn't like what it was, the content?
You had one in the Berkshire Eagle recently we discussed about a newspaper issue.
I'd rather not go there.
All right. Okay.
But basically, and I wrote them another column.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gracious enough to do it. Newspapers, as Ira's does, have rules. And one rule, you know, for example, at the Eagle has always been one columnist does not attack another column. In this case, that was not the problem. But I was writing about stuff, you know, the kind of stuff that we speak about here, editorial issues and advertisers and the rest of it. And I think they said, we'd rather not do this. I frankly don't blame them. That's what they decided. And I had no problem with there are columnists, by the way, who go to the wall and to Mars and say, you can't and you won't. But I think that the people who run the newspapers have a right to run their newspapers.
I generally would say that a columnist, this person is designated a columnist, has the right to write a column that I certainly don't agree with. But there are times, you know, I mean, our job leading these enterprises is to reflect upon the appropriate message and the taste of the community and that kind of thing. So,
by the way, that extends to letters to the editor. And that brings to the whole question that Alan has raised numerous times about the difference between what we allow on the website versus what we allow in print. Much of what we allow on the website would never see the light of day in print because in print, historically, I think people don't understand this either, is when you submit a letter to the editor, we have a responsibility for what goes in our newspaper, and we want it to be interesting. Again, we don't have to agree with it, but if it rambles, if the language is not clean, we're either not going to use it or we're going to edit it. But if we edit it, we're not changing the person's opinion. We're just trying to clean it up.
Although they always claim that you have.
That's great.
Right.
We had a case recently. I'm sure Rex has had this 100 times. A superintendent of a school district wrote us a letter because he wanted to make the case for his district's budget. And the caveat said, you must run this in its entirety. We will not accept any editing. No. We didn't even read it.
Yeah.
And we saw that line. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We're not going to do that.
My title, by the way, is editor.
Yes.
That means we edit.
Before we go, can I ask both of you guys a question? How long have we been doing this program together? All these years, right?
Many years.
Now, you know, Ira and Rex, this business about, Ira, you got this big fat wedding ring on your thing, and you always go, against the thing, and, you know, against the thing, and you bang on the table, Rex. I want you guys to cut it out.
but Rush Limbaugh has made a thing out of
this.
Yeah,
and I think you ought to,
papers.
It's time that we,
what he wants.
It's time we live stream this event so people will see.
We ought to go to an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
And let the record show that this big fat wedding ring I've been wearing for 42 years still fits. So I wasn't that fat 42 years ago, and it still fits on the finger.
I don't think he meant fat in that context.
Right.
I think he was talking about the gold content.
I would never criticize Ira.
I
would never criticize Ira's weight.
Well, right now, I think the four of us are going to leave the room. You know, the four of us, it's Alan, and it's Ira, and it's Rex, and Rex's imaginary friend Harvey, who's going to be here because of his Jimmy Stewart impression.
Come on, Harvey.
I love Jimmy Stewart.
Thanks, folks.
I didn't agree politically, but, you know, you had a little.
You wouldn't run his column.
We better go now before we get into all this.
I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.